Hello and welcome to Note-Up. This is episode 50. I'm D. Shaw, and today I'm joined by Isaac Sluder.
Hello.
Bert Belder.
Hey.
Trevor Norris.
Hello.
And TJ Fontaine. Oops. Sorry, TJ.
That's fine. I'm used to being marginalized.
We're going to be talking about the Node 0.11 update, and today we're sponsored by AndYet. Thank you, AndYet. So we have a fair amount of the Node core team, and you guys probably know all of them, but why don't you guys go around and introduce yourselves and let everybody know what you're famous for. Isaac, you want to start us out?
Sure. I'm Isaac Sluder. I wrote NPM. I've been on NodeUp like a bazillion times, and everybody's probably sick of me by now.
Bert.
Hey, I'm Bert. Live from Amsterdam. I'm known for Node, I suppose, and libuv, and being like the Windows guy in many contexts. That's it. Trevor?
Hey, I'm Trevor Norris. I'm probably best known for breaking the Buffer API.
I'm TJ Fontaine. I'm the buildmeister at the moment. I'm the one that made the Jenkins bot that yells at you when you submit your pull request on GitHub.
Sweet. Awesome. So the 0.11 unstable branch has been plugging along. How long has it been? How long have you been in 0.11?
Oh, I don't know. It's too long. I expected it would be about 3 months, and it's been like two or three times that, so probably almost done now.
End of March was the 0.11.0 release. So
So we're not that much. We're not that far over our deadline. Yeah. That's pretty good.
Yeah. So 0.11 has been plugging along. We have 4-point releases. What's been going on, Isaac?
So it's like your standard unstable node branch. So we've been doing a whole bunch of breaking stuff. I think the things that we discussed wanting to cover here are there's a bit of a refactor in the HTTP library. There is some stream refactoring that I've called Streams 3 just to like get everybody excited and afraid. there is a bunch of a lot of performance improvements and some like seriously breaking changes in the Buffer API and in the V8 API layer. And a couple of other things that we need to still get done, which are not done yet. So those will be coming before 0.12 lands.
Okay, so what's this thing about Streams 3? I think that's going to be a big surprise to most people. I thought Streams 2 was perfect.
No. Well, if you think Streams 2 is perfect, you clearly haven't been using it that much. it's a perpetual problem in software design that you really can't like write perfect software and get it right without actually using it in real life and figuring out all the problems. So, that's how the Streams API has been progressing within the limits of backwards compatibility for the most part. So Streams 2 fixed a few things and added like this other way to consume readable streams, which is really useful in some cases, but actually not as useful in some other cases. So people still would end up using the on data event. That's fine. You know, that's a perfectly reasonable way to consume a stream, except the problem is in Streams 2, once you switch into compatibility mode where it's just a free-flowing Streams 1 style stream, there is no way to go back. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that there were some cases where if you are just in, you know, piping from a readable stream into a writable stream, performance was not as good as it could be. Which led to some issues, and there was like some kind of like kludgy stuff that we were doing in the HTTP layer, such that when you look at the socket object on a request or response, it's not quite like a normal TCP socket on a TCP server in Node. So that was kind of a bit of like API weirdness, and it just not very nice. So with Streams 3, we got rid of that on data on end method kludgy stuff. And so the TCP socket behaves just like a normal stream that happens to be flowing. You can hit pause. You can call the pause method, and then it'll go back to, you know, a stream that's not flowing. And so you can, you know, you can then call the read method and wait for readable events and do the whole bit there. So basically, this modal shift is not just one way, right? You can actually go one direction and then, you know, flow it for a little while and then switch it back over. And because of so then the other thing is, whenever you call read and it returns something, we'll actually emit a data event. So what this means is then the pipe method could get a lot simpler, because all we have to do is listen for data events. Then, and if we know that something is in a flowing mode, when you push a chunk of data into it, we can just emit that event right away if we know that we're going to have to be doing it that way anyway. Versus having to, you know, push it into an array and then emit a readable event, and then the listener for the readable event gets triggered, and then we pull the data out of that array, and this all happens right in the single tick. So like, there's no point, right? You're not actually, there's no need to go through that whole dance if you know where you're going to get to. And so there's a little bit of short circuiting and optimization that we're able to do in order to make that a little more reasonable. And so that lets us remove these kludgy APIs from the guts of HTTP. And basically, I suspect that most people will not notice Streams 3. As far as I can tell, it doesn't make any API difference, except that things that people currently are trying that don't work will now work properly. But in terms of the semantics of it, it's all exactly identical to Streams 2.
So far for me, the thing I'm most excited about is, you know, being able to touch data again and not have it change into compatibility mode. You know, a lot of the Streams 1 stuff that I built had, you know, these audio sort audit tap-ins and
yeah, so you know, like passive listeners.
Passive listeners, right?
Right. So what you can actually do now with this, because when you call read, it will emit a data event. You can have a passive listener that adds a data event handler. When it's still the Streams 2 kind of thing, where when you add a data listener, it starts flowing, because otherwise you won't ever get any data events. Mm-hmm. But you can add a data listener, immediately call pause, and then hand it off to somebody else. And at that point, it will, you know, it'll be just like a normal stream. If they do their own thing with it, then it'll be totally normal, as if they had gotten that stream themselves. But you can kind of spy on what they're doing. So that's kind of nice. There is also an added feature as well. There's a, for writable streams, a cork and uncork method.
Okay. What does that do?
So when you call cork, that says, don't actually flush anything to the underlying write implementation for a while. So it's basically like, you know, if you're connected to a socket or something, there's an underlying thing where we actually call write on that file descriptor to send that data out, right, to the mm-hmm. to the system. While it's corked, it's not going to call. You can call write on your stream on your JavaScript stream object again and again and again, and it'll just store it up in a buffer.
Mm.
So at some point, then you call, you know, as if the underlying stream had been was exerting back pressure.
Right.
Then you can call uncork, and it will flush all that stuff out. Now, for most streams, there's never any good reason to do this, right? For most streams, like, every time I write, I want to write all of it. So, you know, just write everything all the time. However, in TCP streams in particular, and probably in some other cases, there are, you know, there's a bit of overhead for each individual write chunk, because we have to make a, you know, a full TCP round trip for every chunk. And if you're doing HTTP chunked encoding, then that's really, really onerous to have to do an HTTP round trip for like a 2-byte size indicator. So that led to a lot of, like, you know, silly heuristics, like if it's bigger than this certain number of bytes, then we're just going to concatenate them, because otherwise it requires a copy of the buffer, and that's kind of painful. So we added another method called writeV. You can add an underscore writeV method to your writable class. And then if there is a writeV method, and there's more than one chunk that needs to get flushed out because of having been corked, then it will pass that entire buffer of chunks to your write v method, and you can actually send them all at once if there's some way for you to do that. So we with TCP streams, we do this using the write v method on systems that support it. And yeah, if they don't, then we just write it, you know, bit by bit.
At an implementation level, is this like the, when you have a socket that has you know, the default delay for doing the Nagle algorithm, is that, you know, being used there, or is it irrelevant to that?
This is a little bit different than Nagle. So the thing is, with the Nagle algorithm, it's saying, like, if you're going to be doing a lot of writes really fast, let's, like, you know, when you start writing, let's wait a certain number of milliseconds so we can, like, gather them all up and send them in one TCP buffer.
Okay.
Or one TCP packet. This is a little bit different because it's actually, even if you set no delay true, what this is doing is it's actually doing the delay on your end, so on the user land end. So you can say, like, you know, write, like, I know that I have 10 chunks, and I know after those 10 chunks, I want them all to be sent.
Okay.
But I want them all to be sent in one syscall.
Mm.
Right? So in that case, you know, in terms of how the kernel actually handles that, I'm not entirely sure and don't really care. I just have found experimentally it's a bit faster to do it that way. So it saves a copy and it saves a syscall.
Okay. Cool. So anything else that we should be looking at for Streams 3? Are there new base classes or anything crazy like that?
Nope. For the most part, it's Streams 2, but the Streams 1 API has been officially blessed and folded in and made like an actual part of the thing rather than just being like a kludgy compatibility mode.
Nice. I'm excited for that because I always, you know, the hardest things that I dealt with in the transition from 1 to 2 is I really liked taking the understanding of event emitters and the data events that you see, you know, all throughout Node and, you know, building up towards the aha moment of, like, this is what streams are about underneath. Mm-hmm. And with Streams 2, that was kind of obscured and, you know, untouchable. And it's nice to make that, you know, we can bring that back into the teaching of Streams. And I think that will be a clearer thing for everybody. And plus, we had to kind of dip back into Streams 1 in certain circumstances anyway. Like, we kept kind of going back.
The point of backwards compatibility is we're not just, like, the Streams 1 API was never deprecated. It was never going to be deprecated. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think that just calling it a compatibility mode made people think that it was, like, a deprecated thing they shouldn't touch.
Right on.
It's totally fine, too. Like, from my point of view, like, yeah, use data events if that's the easiest way to consume this data, then just do it that way. So there may be a few other little edge case polishing things that we still need to get in. I think there was something, somebody wanted a way to limit how much data was piped from one reader to a writer. So we're kind of awaiting a pull request on that. You know, most of these things are edge cases that I don't think most people really are going to care about. Like, for the most part, Streams 3 won't be noticed by most people.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure no one will have any objections about it.
Yeah.
Continue believing that. No, that's great. I think, you know, bringing back Streams 1 into you know, the fold and having it be a blessed citizen, I definitely got that impression that it was more deprecated than just... yeah, that is more towards the, you know, being deprecated, that we shouldn't be using it by and large. But, you know, always, you know, it kind of, every time I had a use case for going back to Streams 1, it just felt like, I'm missing something I should be doing, you know, this in a better Streams 2 way.
I should have more lines of code in my program. I should be calling more functions. No, I mean, it's... it's totally fine. The only thing that sucked was that there was no way to come back, right? That compatibility mode was fine. Like, things still moved really quickly. It was just like, we couldn't do it internally. If you're a library, you can't do that, because now if the person who's consuming this stream from you wants to use the newer methods, if they want to consume it like chunk by chunk explicitly, then there's no way to do that. So at least not without wrapping in another stream, which is really, you know, just excessive and weird.
That's something that I don't think you touched on that I remember from last night's meetup, that you can now seamlessly go back and forth between compatibility mode and Streams 2 mode?
Yeah, there's no compatibility mode. It's just, is the stream currently flowing or is it not? Like, is it paused or is it not paused?
Right.
There's an API
around that too, right?
What's that?
There's an explicit API around that.
Yeah, the pause and resume methods.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a flowing property
or something like that? It's flowing.
The flowing property is internal, but okay. we could make that a little more first class and public, I guess. If you ever want something to not be flowing, though, you just call pause, and if you ever want it to be flowing, you just call resume, and those are no ops if there's nothing to do.
Okay.
Not too much more to talk about on that, I guess.
Awesome. So when we started the 0.11 adventure, I remember that the main focus was going to be a refactor of HTTP to make it more maintainable, to make it primarily for maintainability, right? How's that going?
Well, it's for maintainability and also just in general, like being better for a lot of use cases. So some of the streams refactoring is actually a big part of the HTTP refactor. Also, TJ did the grunt work of splitting it up into multiple different files. So now, you know, when you see a stack call with like socket on data, you can actually tell what kind of socket it was, whether it was a client or a server, or have you just by the file name, which is sort of long overdue. That file was
nice.
Something ridiculous. It was like 3,000 lines or some crap. Which, I mean, for a JavaScript file, is just completely
absurd.
So that was a big part of it, and it's made things a lot more maintainable and easy to tell what's going on in tricky cases. What we've also done with the HTTP with the streams refactor, like I said, we were able to remove some kludgy interaction with the net layer, and then there's a sort of a bunch of features that are that have either been landed or are in the process of getting merged in. The right v cork stuff allowed us to remove a big hacky kludge out of the HTTP layer and for chunked encoding, like I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing. Right. So keep alive.
Right.
In the HTTP agent, there's a way the global agent does not have this on by default.
Mm-hmm.
But if you create your own HTTP agent, you can then specify whether you want it to use keep alive.
Right.
And you can specify a keep alive timeout and the max number of sockets and the max number of sockets to have waiting in the pool for keep alive use, and it'll actually do the TCP keep alive with them as well. So that if the other side shuts you down, you can get we can detect that relatively reliably, and also the little KA packets that get sent back and forth will usually keep that from happening. So that's kind of nice. It's a little bit annoying that we have to make it opt in, but it's such a subtle semantic change. There's really no reasonable way to have that on by default.
Wait. All right. So let me stop you there. So Keep Alive has been on by default since for a while. I don't know the history.
Okay. Let me back up a little bit.
Okay.
The connection keep alive header has been sent by the agent forever.
Right. Mm-hmm.
However, the agent had a certain max number of sockets, which is set to for no good reason, set to 5 by default. Five is exactly the wrong number. Basically, there are two cases. There's two use cases that you want for the max number of sockets. Either infinity or some other gigantic number, because every time I make a request, just open up a new socket if you have to. Or one, because I only want to have one connection to this one server and just send all my requests over this one connection. Those are basically like the two main use cases for the HTTP agent, max sockets. Five is like, I don't know, six would be slightly better, four would be slightly better. It is the local minimum of utility for that setting. So anyway, if you have to make a request to a certain server and we're already over the max number of connections to that server, given the max sockets setting, then what it'll do is it'll store that request in a queue, and once a socket frees up, it'll use that socket on the queue. Every time a request finishes, every time the agent finishes with a socket, it checks to see if there's anything pending to that server in port, and then it'll use that newly freed up socket for that pending request. If there's no pending request, it immediately terminates the socket. It just destroys it.
Mm-hmm.
So technically, yes, it is using keep alive, but it's not using keep alive in any kind of reasonable way, because let's say you make a request to the server once every second, right?
Mm.
Well, I make a request, I get a response, and now there's nothing pending, so it just destroys the connection. Then a second later, I make another request and get another response. Nothing pending, so it destroys the connection. So every second I'm doing this TCP setup phase, which is a little bit expensive. If I know I'm going to use it soon, I can just say, like, please keep this alive. Like, I guarantee I'm going to use it. Don't terminate it immediately. And so with a more reasonable keep alive agent, what you can do is say, like, okay, unref the socket so it doesn't keep the program open, but sort of hang on to it in a pool and then try to reuse it later. So that's what the agent does now if you set those keep alive options.
Okay. But we're still like there is an AP that is a it's not a behavior change, but it is kind of an expectation change, right?
It is a behavior change. But okay. But only if you opt into it. The default behavior is still pretty much identical, with the difference that the HTTP max sockets setting is infinity rather than 5.
Okay, so that has been sort of rectified, I guess.
Yeah, because you like let's say you have a system where you have
that's fantastic.
30 different components that are all little HTTP servers talking
to
each other.
Sure.
A request comes in from a user to your web front end or whatever, and then that has to talk to two different things, and those things have to talk to two different things or whatever. If every connection max sockets is limited to 5, then that means that every time you get these kind of like cascading latency bubbles as you wait for these sockets to terminate. I mean, the bottom line is that Node is not an HTTP, it's not a web browser, and it shouldn't behave exactly the same as a web browser.
Right.
It should behave like a reasonable system, like a reasonable
that sensible
system.
Sorry, that sensible default came from what do browsers do, right? Pretty much,
ostensibly, but not. That's not actually what browsers do.
Okay.
So we're outdated and wrong in every by any reading of it. So in real life, people were setting the max sockets explicitly once they learned about it. And if everybody has to change something about your API, then obviously the default is broken.
Got it. So any other changes to HTTP? Move things around? How are the benchmarks?
Versus 0.10, our benchmarks right now are kind of ridiculous because mostly because of some V8 and buffer changes that mix things up a lot.
Cool. We'll get into that in a second.
Mm-hmm.
Any other changes to HTTP that we should highlight?
You know, mostly just like minor like polishing type things that for one reason or another made slight API additions or changes, so we couldn't land them in were just risky, so we couldn't land them in 0.10.
Such as?
Oh, hold on. Oh, yeah. We need to do the socket upgrade API is kind of terrible, and there's a open issue right now that I've been meaning to get to. Issue 4813. So now that we have this Streams 3 API, this actually frees us up to do slightly more interesting things with our WebSocket APIs.
And Speedy too, right? Doesn't Speedy do an upgrade?
I'm not sure. Maybe.
Next protocol negotiation.
I don't know very much about Speedy.
I could be wrong, but I believe it does next protocol negotiation, and that's through an upgrade event.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, there's 11 open bugs right now, bugs and pull recs about HTTP. Mostly, like, you know, handling duplicate headers and improving the some other random things. Yeah.
So are we going to get full web dev support in 11?
Probably not.
Okay. Probably not. That was an interesting issue with the multiple headers. That is that a really big rewrite to get that?
Oh, to get like custom methods?
No, not the custom HTTP methods, but that behavior in how the headers are handled. Having multiple headers.
Oh. Well, I mean, the thing is, like, we have certain there are certain headers that we allow to be multiples, and other headers that we don't.
Okay.
The semantics of HTTP are really like kind of annoying to deal with. It sounds like DAV should be one of those headers that we allow multiples of.
Okay, so there's already kind of a pattern that we can use internally.
Right. But like, if you send two content type headers, and we represent that as an array in your application, like that's stupid because there's very clear cut semantics that the second content type header overrides the first, and in fact, you should really only ever send one. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and I mean same thing with like host headers, and then there's other things where the first overrides the second. I mean, there's like a dozen or so RFCs that deal with all this. It's like it's kind of a nightmare, but we're not just going to make all duplicate headers allowed.
Right on.
I think if we add this thing for web dev, I mean, that's a pretty easy change to make. Anyway.
Cool. All right. So we'll get into. Sorry.
Oh, so one thing I do want to say though is we will add. I am planning on getting in relatively soon a way, like a first class way to access the raw header section of the HTTP request, which, you know, especially for doing proxies and some other use cases, you really want to get like the low level access to the headers as just like, you know, an array of strings or something, so you can see exactly like what their case was and, you know, what order they came in and so on. So I think that'll probably make Joaquin Canes happy.
Cool. All right, so we'll get into the buffer changes and V8 changes in a second. I want to put in a good word for our sponsors, And Yet. They are a consulting shop that builds Node APIs and JavaScript SDKs for clients like AT&T. And in addition to building client stuff, they have their own product called AndBang. AndBang is a real-time chat system and a task management system for teams that you can use their web client, IRC, or use their extensive API to roll your own integration. AndBang is free right now while it's in private beta, and you can check out the developer docs for that at andbang.com. The AndBang API is built off their spec, and it generates the SDK and interactive API docs for their interfaces for both a REST API and a Socket.io enabled API. So convenient for, you know, building and extending real-time apps. And, you know, they in addition have really cemented themselves as a leader in the WebRTC space. They have, if you want a quick and dirty Skype, they have a really great WebRTC client that's called Talky, and it's Talky.io, and is use Talky on Twitter, and you can check out the library for that and that's behind that, which is open source, called Simple WebRTC, and you know, they love to help their clients build stuff like you know, single page apps, WebRTC, real time. They you know, are fantastic in that space, and you know, they go well beyond that into you know, really giving back to the community, and have been running, you know, you know, coming will be the third edition of real-time conf, keeping it real-time. I'm really looking forward to that this fall. We'll have a little bit more information about real-time conf at the end of the show. But I hope you'll be there. If you're building anything with you know, real-time interactivity, then I can't recommend enough that you join us at Real-Time Conf. And it's really great to get different perspectives. You know, I spend a lot of time talking to people who are building these things in Node, but at Real-Time Conf, I have the opportunity to take that and compare notes, compare implementation approaches with developers that are doing similar things, but are approaching it with different language, different tools. And last but not least, the Anyet's security wing, Lyft Security, has an extensive set of security services and is behind the Node Security Project, which is you know, helping developers in userland and npm develop more secure modules, and they're currently going through an audit of the entire npm registry, which is really impressive. So big thanks to Anyet, and thanks for all that you do in the Node community, and for supporting NodeUp. So, under the hood, we got some craziness that's been happening. Trevor, do you want to tell us what's been going on with buffers?
Sure. So, basically, we went through and ripped out all the unnecessary bits. Previously, there was an entire buffer C++ class that was instantiated, and then internally it was attached to the buffer object, and it would float around with it. The issue is setting JavaScript property or setting properties on a JavaScript object in native land is freakishly slow. And so what we did was rip all that out and create basically just a regular JavaScript object, set some basic properties on it in JavaScript, attach external memory to it, and then hand that back to the user. So it's been extremely very streamlined in that case. Also, what we did was create another small module that is responsible for external memory allocation on JavaScript objects. It's extremely simple. It doesn't set any properties. All it does is just throw data onto the object, and that new module is called smalloc or smalloc. When I created it, that had a meaning. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it is a new module that allows you to basically pass any object. And what's interesting is not even just Isaac just being small malloc. Sounds good. The interesting part is you can actually allocate memory to more than just a plain object. You can allocate memory to any object type except for an array. And so I'm hoping the community will find interesting ways to use that. You can attach external memory to like a function or even a regex. It's really weird. I don't know what they would use it for, but hey, go wild, try it out. One important change, well, among others, is now if you take a heap dump, it will not show under buffer. It will show under Smalloc.
Hmm.
Because moving forward, whenever we do need to, if ever we need to allocate external memory to an object for a given reason, we're going to use this this mini module instead, because it's just, it's specifically created for that thing. It's very tiny and it does just exactly that, and that's all. Also, it does break the C++ API. Before, it would actually return a buffer class instance, and now it just returns a local object. And so a lot of people previously, immediately what they would do is get the buffer class instance and then grab the underscore handle, which was basically the object, the buffer object itself, and then return that back to JavaScript land. And so I didn't really see the need for the entire class. Instead, yeah, now we're just returning the local object right off the bat.
Now, have you got any impression that that's going to break, modules and NPM?
Oh, yeah, it will.
It's going to be like 100% we need to recompile everything change like we had between 6 and 8?
Yeah, but to be honest, the from seeing the use cases, it's usually a one-line change. Like, literally, people will take the class. I mean, I'm talking 99% of the cases. People take the class instance and then return back the JavaScript object from the class instance. I mean, that's what they use it for.
Mm-hmm.
And so really what they'll need to do basically is just delete the underscore or the handle underscore bit, and it will just itself return the object instead. That's going to be the general fix for the community. And to be quite honest, in comparison to the V8 changes coming down the pipe, upgrading their buffer API is going to be very trivial.
Okay. I remember early on you were working on thin buffers. Is that still a thing?
No, that was an extremely dangerous thing.
It sounded awesome. Yeah. It was fast, right?
It was ridiculously fast. I mean, like, insanely
fast.
But the issue is that we weren't letting V8 know what was going on in the background. And so, like, what we could do is create a scope around a local object, assign some memory to it, return it to the function. But then you'd have to make sure that you don't grab a slice of that buffer. You'd have to make sure you don't take any, like, you don't assign that to a variable outside of that function or anything else, because as soon as it came back from JavaScript within that same function, it destroyed the object. Mm-hmm. And if you misuse it, you would just fail with a double memory corruption. And there was no way to warn about that.
Okay. Now, that was, I remember in that discussion, that was, our savior for efficient TLS. Is that... do we have an approach that is come in and taken over what thin buffer was going to be able to do, or is that still an unsolved problem?
Well, actually, the new buffer API, is a little over 3 times faster than the old C++ buffer API. So we've found that like the changes we've made already have already increased performance quite a bit. And it just offers a lot more stability. I mean, it's been fast enough that we've been able to remove the slab allocator completely. And for those who don't understand what that was, basically in the background, it would allocate 1 meg, I believe, of memory, and then take slices of it as requests came in and then handed that off. Few people saw memory leaks, though, because like they would receive an HTTP header or some data, and then they would take a slice of that, and then they would just keep it around indefinitely. The problem there is that it would have to hang on to the entire 1 megabyte chunk of data in the background until all the slices were left scope. And so by being able to remove the slab allocator completely and making each call its own discrete chunk of memory, we've removed that possibility for memory leak.
About Dishat, so just to touch on your question about efficient TLS, one of the things that was also done by Fedor and Dutney was actually to move the cryptos, you know, deprecate the CryptoStreams API, which, you know, I think there was like one module in NPM that used it directly anyway, and instead move the interaction between Node and OpenSSL completely into the C++ layer. So now, just like we have a TCP wrap low-level object, we now have a TLS wrap low-level object, which handles all of that stuff. You can still get at the actual socket properties, but it's just a slightly different couple of steps to get at that. And we still have the start TLS support in there if you already have a socket. But for the vast majority of use cases, there's zero API change. It's just, instead of having this this thing where we have data that comes out of the C++ layer as a JS socket object, and then we immediately turn around and put it back into, you know, C++ to feed it to OpenSSL, and then immediately pull it out of OpenSSL back into JavaScript again, it's now just one boundary cross then instead of like three.
Oh, nice. So performance delta?
TLS is a lot faster as a result.
Okay. Right on. And are we going to be able to say that we have, you know, fast enough SSL for 1.0?
For a lot of people, it's fast enough already. But, it's still to be determined whether you should use Node TLS directly or go through Stud. I mean, it kind of depends on your use case.
Okay.
I would like Node to be a competent TLS terminator, but I don't know. I don't know how realistic that'll be in the near term.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the plan for right now, probably not a blocker to 1.0.
No, I mean, 1.0 is just the plan for 1.0 is that it's 0.12 but faster and more stable. So
okay. That is a fast.
Okay. Yes, TLS means faster would be a fast. So I don't know. Not making any firm commitments though. I can't see the other side of that. So we'll see where we are when we get there.
Okay, so there have been a bunch of changes to the underlying V8. I forget off the top of my head, what the delta and the version numbers are, but it's fairly significant. What does anyone want to talk about what's going on there and the impact of it?
I guess I'll step up.
All right.
Whatever, you can. I don't care. Whatever. No. I'll start. In 10, we're using V8 3.14, and in 11 right now we're at V8 3.20. So the changes are basically going to result in, for binary module authors, having to touch their every exported function that they have. They'll have to update the signature or get some unpleasant deprecated warnings in some cases. So they're going to have to actually, if they want their code to compile cleanly, they're going to have to update their module. So that's what's coming for them. to that effect, to try and aid that, I'm starting to write a module to help some people with that pain, because you're going to have to rewrite your module, or at least touch your module. I've started a project called Node Add-on Layer, which I'm hoping will get merged into Node Core at some point. But it'll allow you to target with a simple C API either 8, 10, and 12 going forward. So it's working right now. I have my own tests. I have my own test suite, and I have another guy from the community who has been working on a module himself. He's kind of my guinea pig, and he's giving me feedback on what is working, what's not working, and what other APIs I haven't implemented yet. So that's starting up anyway.
Now, some of this, new native API module there, some of this comes from the SpiderMonkey JS API. Is that correct, or is that an inspiration, a source of fear?
Yeah, it's all of the above. So I've done module or bindings for anything from .NET through PNVoc or Ruby and Python. So I've done a fair bit of work on those other platforms. So when I got to Node, it was a little interesting to see that we don't exactly have a good story on how we support authors who want to write binary modules. So I was, as I was looking through different examples, I was going to write a blog post and talk about Ruby and Python, and then I came across the JS API and realized it's kind of close to what I had envisioned for an API. And when I told people that, I was like, well, you know, maybe one day we could actually support the SpiderMonkey backend as well as the V8 backend. I kept having arguments about whether or not that was actually possible or not. So in the meantime, you know, I have taken away everything that looks it, some of the pieces that look too much like JS API, just so that we can avoid that part of the conversation and we can get people talking about the kind of interface that they want to have, the kind of stable interface that they want to have when writing binary modules for Node. So
okay, nice, because that's broken a lot, and that's been an area where we've been sort of more liberal on our willingness to break those APIs, right?
Yeah, and for people who want to use V8 directly, this won't stop you from using V8. You'll still be able to use V8. But if you want a more stable API and ABI, so we won't have to worry as much about recompiling your module for every major or minor version release of Node, you'll be safe. You'll have a little bit more peace of mind about the whole scenario.
What's an ABI?
So you have your application programming interface, that's your API, okay.
Uh-huh.
And you have your application binary interface, which refers to the actual layout of the bytes in structs and across method across function calls. So you want to make sure that it, regardless of what you may change, the binary structures themselves are compatible across releases.
Got it. Okay, cool. I think Isaac touched on it briefly, but a lot of the things that are going on in the V8 upgrade are, you know, giving us more fast.
Yeah, right? Maybe Trevor wants to talk more about the benchmarking on that side of things.
Okay. From the V8 upgrade?
Yep.
A couple nice things I've noticed are that the cost of traversing the JavaScript and C++ boundaries have been reduced. Unfortunately, nice. Setting object properties on a JavaScript object are still ridiculously slow. Why? I don't know, but they are.
Just to clarify, you mean from C++. Like, doing that in JavaScript is still very, very, very fast.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Also, there are some wonderful new APIs. Like, they've deprecated their old like string write, and instead they've replaced it with more specific string write 1 byte, write 2 byte, write UTF-8. And by doing it that way, they've actually increased the performance quite a bit in like writing strings from, like, taking a buffer and writing a string from it has become substantially faster because of that. Now, there are some strange gotchas because of that. For example, the new persistent object. Previously, for any native module developers, you probably understand the difference between a local and a persistent handle. The persistent handle now no longer inherits from handle. And so you have to do some quirky things when, like, converting back and forth for returning them and stuff like that. I don't think I could even possibly try to fully explain it, like, right now, your best bet is to look at like the V8 tests, or I mean, even look at how we upgraded Node to get an idea of how to make those changes.
Go ahead, please.
Oh, I was going to continue past this to another thing, but continue with your question.
Oh, is there a a work in progress upgrade guide, 10 to 12 yet?
I've been keeping notes, and I think I have a poorly updated wiki page about it. Mm-hmm. But to be honest, I know that there are still API changes coming from V8 before 12 is going to be released.
So it's just too early for that?
It might be. I mean, I should probably document that better. But yeah, like there will still be more API breaking changes coming down the pipe before 12 is released.
So since there's so much, potentially moving for binary module developers, it might be nice to get that out early so, we can get some feedback on that.
Yeah. Okay. And then one thing Isaac made in Master, which has been super helpful and I was able to continue on with, was new string bytes. We use that internally. Isaac, you go ahead and talk about it.
So basically the string bytes, it's a C++ class, with just like a, I don't know, it's basically just a class, like a static class to have some methods hanging off of it. And it's just a single API. It's like a single place in our API where we could convert buffers to strings and get the data out of JavaScript string objects and take, so there's two things, right? You either have like a char star and a length of just like random bytes in C++. And you can say, here's some bytes and here's the number of bytes that I have, and please make this a string. Pretend that this is like UTF-8 encoded. And then it will return you a handle to a string object. Or the other thing you can do is you can get a JavaScript handle, a V8 handle to a string object and say, here's a string. It's a UTF-8 string. Please give me the chunk of data that is in this string. This is obviously something we have to do quite a bit in Node because you write strings places and you get strings back from things, or you have to interpret a buffer as a string or create a new buffer from a string. But we had a lot of various different implementations of this kind of scattered throughout the Node code base with various different semantics and bugs. And so just, drying that up in a single spot, it sort of, as you do with, drying up code, it sort of opened the door for making more optimizations and smarter choices about things that would yield benefits across Node. The actual work of it was basically just kind of tedious, like cleanup stuff, but Trevor's taken that a little bit further and done some actual clever things with it.
Yeah, the part of the new V8 API is you can have these things called externalized strings. There's a specific point when the V8 GC for some reason blows just pukes if you have a string, if you're converting a buffer of some size to a string. Okay. And so with these externalized strings, what you can do is just take a direct copy of memory and then tell V8 to look at it as a string. Unfortunately, this only works for 1-byte and 2-byte strings, or basically you can think of it as like our binary encoding or Latin 1 or UCS2, right? It's UTF-8 is not supported. Okay. So being able to do that, we've really been able to increase performance. Binary string encoding performance has increased by like 2,300%.
Wow.
And yeah, so being able to push that, it's also helpful because if it is an externalized string and then you want to convert a string to a buffer, then all it costs is a mem copy instead of having extracted out of the V8 heap completely.
Nice.
So yeah, there are some really good performance enhancements we were able to do because of that. Oh, and last thing was we've migrated completely to the V8 implementation of typed arrays.
Oh, for what?
Oh, like the whole array buffer, like basically the entire typed array implementation we had implemented, or I don't know who, somebody had implemented one in Node because mm-hmm. the array buffer and like data view wasn't a native type in V8.
Okay.
And so V8 has implemented it since then, and we are now using that implementation instead of Node's old implementation.
Wasn't that Ryan in the whole push to isolates? Maybe I'm recalling history incorrectly.
Isaac, I don't know.
Isaac, that's a question for you, Isaac.
sorry, I was getting distracted by the folks in the chat room. While there was an open issue about Keep Alive sucking in Node, and while TJ was talking, I went in and closed it. So I'm sorry. Nice. What was the issue about? You were talking about array
about
buffers.
The original array, the original typed array implementation, and now that it's been removed with the new V8 API.
Oh yeah, it's just that there was no typed array implementation in V8. It was implemented in Chrome for the browser. And they've moved that into V8, so now we can take advantage of their implementation of it, which is a little more first class in the VM. So makes sense for them to handle it. Nothing to do with isolates.
Okay, got it. There was hope that typed array implementation would be useful for something. Are we using it for anything?
Well, I mean, we're using it for typed arrays. It's if it was so, the thing that would be kind of nice, right? As more web browser code is starting to use binary streams and so on and so forth, it would be nice to have similar APIs. So you get an array buffer on the browser, and in Node you get this other like weirdo buffer thing. It would be kind of nice if we used array buffers instead of buffers in Node, but I don't know if that's ever going to happen. And if it does, we'll still have to have backwards compatibility anyway. So it's, I don't know. Trevor, do you want to talk to some of the speak to some of the actual choices as far as why type arrays for us?
Yeah, honestly, it's just all really comes down to performance. They've done an amazing job at implementing it and making it really fast. But, okay, so for example, you have the array buffer, and the array buffer is not indexable. Like our current buffer, you return one back, and then you can just access the data via the indices, right? In order to do that, we would actually have to cast a uint8 typed array over the array buffer, and that second instantiation just pushes performance over the edge. At least TJ is convinced that we will be able to move that to them one day, and I am all for it if performance can match, but just from my experience, that most likely will never happen.
Well, you know, there's a lot of work that's going on right now. I mean, the typed array, especially the array buffer port, is being worked on a lot. And more recently, in the past week and even last night, there was a commit to V8 master that actually makes it look even more like our own buffer implementation. So I think there's a hope for it. I mean, the major difference between an array buffer and our buffer implementation is what the semantics of slice. That's the main difference, where we continue slicing pieces of the same buffer and you're changing the same underlying memory, whereas with the array buffer, my understanding is that when you slice, you're actually getting a different piece of memory at that point. Is that correct, Trevor?
Yeah, that is correct. The way that you're technically supposed to do it is create another a view over an existing array buffer, and so the slice semantics follow array in that it just copies the memory instead.
So in browser land, typed arrays are important for WebGL, right? So is that correct?
Yes. Also,
not a group of. What's that?
They're good for any number of whenever you need to work with binary data or do super super quick operations. Like you can make if you need to do a lot of numeric computations, like linear or vector computations, they're really useful for that.
Right on. So I know that Google's kind of been on a push, and a lot of people have been on a push to like WebGL, all the things. So improving performance of that, is going to be a priority for Google. So yeah, maybe.
Yeah, and like I really am totally for it if the performance can come on par with Buffer.
Awesome. So a couple more small things. I've heard there's a change in timers. There was originally some discussion about flipping the semantics between set immediate and process next stick. Did that happen? What's going on there?
That was never a realistic discussion. And it was never a realistic option. Oh, you know, while we're at it, why don't we rename Nest to TCP? Like, node 0.x, I'll change all the things. No, we're not going to change the semantics of Nextick. Like, it is what it is, staying. So what we did have, there is this warning if you do a recursive Nextick operation that goes more than 1,000 deep because you're spinning on CPU, you're in a busy loop. Mm-hmm. Now it's just going to let you busy loop for as long as you need to, and it doesn't have that warning and defer. So, you know, hopefully you've gone through the 0.10 cycle where it was warning you about that, and when you upgrade to 0.12, you've already started using set immediate for stuff that needs to actually be deferred.
Okay. And so what's going on with set immediate?
So,
oh yeah, you can go ahead.
Yeah. So when I implemented set immediate for 10, I made the design decision that for every turn of the event loop, we would only process one queued callback for set immediate. Sounded like a great idea at the time, but when you start queuing a bunch of these things, you realize that it can take considerable amount of time to actually process through all of those. So in 12, the semantic change for set immediate is any and all callbacks that have been queued during the last turn of the event loop will be processed, and then any subsequent immediates that are queued while those are processing will happen on the next turn of the event loop. We have to be careful. The discussion about next tick and set immediate changing was because we like to say tick for an event loop, but
right.
that's difficult to get the messaging right on that. So yeah, I'm going to steal from Forrest, and we're just going to start calling it turn more often. So set immediate happens once per turn, and all of the queued callbacks during the past turn will be processed once in the turn, and then so on and so forth. So it doesn't have the same kind of recursive problem that process next tick might have, but happens a little bit faster than what was happening in 10.
It's even more immediate.
That's correct.
Okay. Awesome. Cool. I was looking forward to a really crazy internal breaking change like that. We still have time. It's still not 1.0, but okay. We too have our own cruft. So there's that's kind of the state of 11 now. There are some upcoming things in the road to 0.12. What's going on there, Bert? What are you up to?
Well, let me first mention something that actually has been done already awesome. By Ben. So, but it's kind of internal to Node. Or to libuv even. If you ever use libuv, you'll notice that it would usually return a value, which some result value, and we would give you -1 or a null pointer if a failure happened, and then you had to do this kind of tedious thing where you got the last read the last error from the event loop, and then it was a struct, so you had to like look at some member and see what was going on. And Ben has been working to change all that. And basically, now we're just returning the error itself, which is always a negative value. So it's not a massive change, but one that makes it a little easier to use. And that was important. And now we're coming to what's still coming. Ben Nordhuis is working on making Node be able to run in multiple V8 contexts. So a context right now is something you can create with the VM module, but it doesn't offer all that flexibility. And when you actually try to use Node APIs in those contexts, you run into trouble. So he's been working on separating it more, and this may seem not very exciting, but it is basically a step towards Isolates, the project that you mentioned, which we canceled 1.5 years ago.
Right.
and at the time, it was just there were too many holes in our story in libuv, and mm-hmm. It was too hard to get it done. But nowadays, I think most of the ingredients are there, and we're slowly moving towards there. So that means you'll be possibly able to create threads in the far future in Node, but that's not something we will do before 0.1.
Right. Well, and part of the problem with Isolates, if I recall correctly, is that they were just slow, right?
Well, they were not super slow, but you had that the problem was that V8 at the time, when you used V8 methods, V8 would do a lookup in the so-called thread local storage to see what is the V8 isolate that's currently active, basically. Like a V8, you have to think of a V8 isolate as like a separate VM that might run in a separate thread, like totally independent from any other isolates. But actually, the recent V8 API changes changed this, so you can now be explicit about the isolate you're using. So in theory, most of those problems should be solved. The other problem was also that it made Node a lot, Node's internals a lot messier, because whenever we need to access, for example, a JavaScript property in from C++, then we have to create a so-called symbol. Well, that was the old API, and the new API would just create a string and fill it with some data, and then V8 could use that string as the object key or whatever. And what we would do is create all these strings up front, because that means that saves time whenever you need to read the callback property of something, for example. You do that many times, so we would just cache the key. But if we would do isolates, actually we would have to make the key for every isolate, because they are shared nothing. You cannot have a string that's a string in two isolates at the same time. And that would add another lookup. So it would just make the code less readable and a little bit slower, yes. But so a lot of this has been addressed in recent V8 API changes. Also, there were some issues with libuv at the time that have been solved. For example, only one libuv event loop could drive child processes and receive signals from the system, and that's all been fixed as well. So yeah, we might make another attempt. It's not, it's not a huge priority or something. It's just interesting to be able to go in that direction again. Yeah, and then there are some small things coming up. I've been, it's maybe a little similar to the isolate story. We've been working on getting exec sync, basically run a program and block while it's doing that into Node Core. That doesn't sound like a huge deal, but I think in Node, we offer a fairly rich, range of options and semantics. Actually, that's very nice. I think in many cases, it's so much easier in Node to manage a bunch of child processes than it is, for example, in Python. But in order to support all that and be able to do it in a synchronous way, doesn't sound very complicated, but in fact, what we need to do is create a nested loop within the libuv event loop and create all the pipes that we want to use to communicate with the child process there, and set a timer in that loop so we can kill it after a while if it if it hangs or something. And yeah, that's now it's I'm supposed to do this. It's just work, but it's a lot of copy pasting and also a lot of reinventing stuff that Node already does, but in a different way. For example. Right. Right now in Node, whenever we create a communications pipe, we do it in JavaScript. But since I now need to create a pipe in a different loop, which you cannot do in JavaScript, I have to re-implement this all in C++. It just takes time.
Right.
It's not that terrible, though.
Is that something that the rest of the existing APIs would move over to? Or
what do you mean? No, exec sync... No, that, that
no,
would
no,
be,
not not exact sync, but the new APIs in libuv that you're building to do exact sync. Is that
no,
good? Like,
well, no, no. It, unfortunately, there will be a lot of duplication. The reason, of course, is that in Node, you actually want, if you do spawn, you actually get access to these pipes. You want them to be created in JavaScript and to be, and you need them to be full blown stream objects. But when you're in C++ and you're dealing with another loop, then you can do that. There's, you know, libuv prevents it, and otherwise the outer loop that you want to block would actually need to be need to run. Otherwise, the pipe couldn't send and receive data.
Got it.
And yeah, so I have to do that, and so I have to find a way to make that work. And one way would obviously be make it possible in JavaScript to run multiple event loops. And I tried that for a while, but it makes it very it's very dangerous and messy. So
yeah, it sounds scary.
Exactly. So I'm now going for the tedious but, you know, safe or reliable solution. But yeah, that's all there is to say for exact sync. I think it's been long overdue. And for example, there's projects like Shell.js and Grunt, which uses that, that would really benefit from being able to do this. All right. And then what's also coming up, and I'm also not working on this actually, is Contextify moving into core, or, you know, maybe not Contextify itself, but the features that it offers. So one of the problems is that JS DOM, which is an important script or module for the Node community,
right,
needs a sandbox to run untrusted JavaScript in. Mm-hmm. And it needs particular semantics that currently our VM module doesn't offer. However, like, what our VM module does offer is not all that different. It's just, you know, in the nitty gritty details that the problems are. And so, yeah, it in my opinion, it should have been done a long time ago. But yeah, we're adding basically the possibilities of Contextify to Node Core, so you can run JS DOM without compiled extensions. So I think that would be great. Compiling extensions is always a bit terrible. And by the way, Dominic De Nicola is working on this. So any questions you should ask to him?
Yeah. As always eventually happens with every module, somebody writes something good and then disappears and doesn't really want to maintain it anymore. It's Dominic will end up taking it over.
And then you give it to Dominic, right?
it goes to Dominic's home for orphan modules. So that's where Contextify is. Well, actually, that's where JS DOM is, and that's why he's leading the charge on this. I think if our VM module doesn't work for JS DOM, it's broken.
Yeah, it's pointless. And I think
that's
kind
the whole point of that module.
Agreed.
Yeah, it was the ultimate use case for it, and still one of the main ones.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's not so many. Like, why do you really need a separate context created from, you know, your main script? It's usually when you want to isolate stuff. I can't really think of another solution reason for it. Sorry.
If you want to simulate a like what a web browser does, right? So let's say I want to scrape a page, and it's like one of these stupid single page apps that has like just fetches JSON and the whole thing is generated in JavaScript. Like, mm-hmm. Geez, that's really painful to do in a way that's safe without being able to run JavaScript in a little sandbox of like a window object.
Yeah,
and especially, I mean, if you want to actually like realistically simulate iframes and all that other crap, you need to be able to have, you know, isolated things that are actually like behave like you'd expect them to.
Indeed. So yeah, that's all the news I have. There's what's still coming. I think in a somewhat longer feature is that we want to move more stuff into C++, but that's not happening before 0.12, and probably also not before, not all before 1.0. But for example, we think that HTTP could benefit a lot if we don't do so much data juggling in JavaScript. Mm-hmm. For example, Tim Caswell has been doing some benchmarks where he just used libuv from Node, actually, but like used the raw bindings to libuv and to the HTTP parser, and he was able to get, you know, twice the performance for Keep Alive Hello World benchmarks. And so, well, in reality, it wouldn't matter as much, of course, because your app would be dominated by all the stuff you do when a request comes in, and not you're doing more than just saying hello world. But I think it indicates that there is a lot of performance gain still to be had, and we're really going for it.
Yeah, there's kind of this there's a perpetual like back and forth between it seems like every part of Node has been in C++ and in JavaScript multiple times. And it's sort of like people debating whether things belong in userland or in kernel space. It's like everybody's like, oh, we should do TCP in userland and we should move V8 into the kernel, and like, yeah, okay, you're all idiots. Like, we're not gonna do any of that. But we kind of do similar things in Node where we like move stuff from C++ into JavaScript, because then it's all in JavaScript. We don't have to do the boundary cross, so it's better performance. And then it's like, oh, well, if we were doing this in C++, it'd be faster, so let's move it back into C++. And there's also, like, obvious, like, usability and barrier to entry issues where, like, you know, most Node developers are not C++ developers. Most of them are JavaScript developers. So if we have stuff in JavaScript, you can, like, you know, more people can kind of crack open the code and find bugs and help us out with it. And also, if we're doing things in C++ and we want them to go faster, then, like, we can't just yell at V8 to make it go faster. but at the same time, we have more control over it going faster. So it's like, I suspect that will be an ongoing tension in Node pretty much forever.
Yeah, I think it's also a little bit on who you ask, because me and Ben Nordhuis have the tendency to move stuff to C++ or to at least want that, and Isaac is always like, nah, let's keep it where it is. And then yeah, it's true, but I think, like, we've been fairly pragmatic about it.
Yeah,
it's not that we just think it will be faster. We know it will be faster, and you know, even by just eliminating a lot of the craft in HTTP.js or a lot of the JavaScript stuff that's going on, it was possible to make it a lot faster. And then, yeah, I mean, there's other areas. For example, I think it was TJ actually who proposed that we rip out series entirely and switch to a JavaScript DNS client. I mean, I'd be fine with that. That seems totally reasonable.
And and it removes the dependency.
Yeah, and indeed.
It's kind of always nice.
Yeah.
OpenSSL too. We should just port all of that.
Wow. So is there any, most developers are watching the evolution of Node, and you know, businesses are looking for things going towards 1.0. What about libuv? Is there a corresponding 1.0 point for libuv? What's going to happen there?
Well, I mean, it, like, so for Node, for a big part, obviously the 1.0 version, you know, it's pointless. I think Isaac has said this many times on this show, so let me not repeat it. But yeah, I mean, Node got a little bit better again, and now we're saying, well, it's good enough, and you know, that makes it 1.0. I think for libuv, we are not really into marketing so far. Okay. So
I love the libuv website, by the way. if you haven't been to libuv.org, probably
you
one of the best
there.
Websites on the internet.
It has
right?
it has all the downloads. So, yeah, that's.
oh, it has everything. It has everything you need.
Everything you need
about how to use libuv. Right. It has the tarball with the source code, and it has. The other tarballs with other versions of the source code, and
it supports HTTP range requests, so you know, you can download it partially if you want to.
Oh,
whatever.
Yeah, you clearly did not write this in Node then.
I think it runs Nginx or so. Yeah.
Probably.
It's actually running on Joyin, so nobody knows.
No, it's Nginx. It says it's pretty obvious.
Okay, cool. Yeah, what we were talking about, C and C++ or JavaScript.
Right. It would be nice to get the libuv book up on this website, actually.
Oh, yeah. For the libuv website, yeah. I've been planning to make something for it, but I'm not a designer. So, you know, if anyone's listening who is actually a good designer, you know,
who's the guy who wrote that that libuv book?
Please do it. Nikhil Marath or something. I don't know how to pronounce his name.
Yeah, we should. That should be this website.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. But, you know, there should probably be a download section on it as well.
Yep.
Yeah, that would be cool. But so speaking of libuv, no, we're not going to WART. I mean, we're going to WART 1.0, but we're not planning on calling it that.
It's kind of an irrelevant thing.
Yeah, exactly. As for Node, we should probably have called, you know, 0.8.1.0 and then, you know, have the party a little bit earlier.
Right. I mentioned this. We had a pretty good party for 0.8 and then another pretty good party for 0.10. And so this way we get more parties, first of all. Nice. Second of all, you know, our bar for backwards compatibility and for version compatibility in Node is actually considerably higher than I think most software programs. I'm not saying that to pat our own back. I'm just saying, like, you know, we have an idea that, like, people kind of have this conception of what 1.0 means, and we're trying to actually do that and be honest about it. Right. Like, between 0.8 and 0.10, there was a bunch of breaking changes, and then we would have had to call that 2.0 or something, and, like, you know, we don't want to be throwing major versions around too aggressively.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, we're being extremely conservative about what we call 1.0. There have been companies building, like, real software on Node for years now. It's definitely ready to use. There's, you know, we don't take our stability indexes lightly. We're very conservative and very serious about maintaining them. When we do break something, you know, or change something in a way that violates our stability index, then we treat that as an extremely high priority, like, serious bug, and we fix it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, between 0.10 and 0.12, yeah, there's all kinds of breaking changes because that's what that version indicates.
Right.
It's a different. It's only stable within that branch.
Yeah, it's interesting though. I mean, where would we want to go after 1.0 or 0.1? Because for many programming languages or platforms, whatever, like once they have reached 1.0, one will be the same. We'll maybe have some API additions, but usually no breaking API changes.
Yeah.
I think
we'll probably stick with the Semver sort of mechanism where, like, 1.1 will have API additions, but no breaking changes. We may even stick with the even odd thing. So, you know, 1.1 is just a shit show, and 1.2 is where we stay stable within that range. Even between 1.0 and 1.2, I don't expect to see many breaking changes. Like, part of getting things to this state where part of the goal here is to get things to a state where we don't have breaking changes, like, ever. That's a high bar to hit. So we'll see if it's possible, but
yeah. Anyway, yeah, libuv is not getting 1.0 yet, and we might change it for a large part. I don't know. We're not working on that.
Libuv is also considerably younger than Node, and I mean, it's impressive how good it is, considering how young it is. I mean, in part because people have been banging on it with Node, and with a couple of other projects, but, like, Node is definitely the big one in that pool.
Yeah. So what's next?
So I had heard that there was a possibility of moving the HTTP parser to JavaScript. Is that idea no longer a thing?
Yeah, so we're going to move the HTTP parser into JavaScript. We're going to move the model system into C++. We're going to move the socket implementation. The handle is going to be moved to JavaScript, but then the socket object is going to get moved to C++. Then we're going to do it all the same, but in reverse.
Yeah, so I guess the honest answer would be, we don't know.
Right?
Like, some people think C++ would be faster. Some people think it would be worthwhile to try it in JavaScript. I think it would be worthwhile to try and do it all in JavaScript.
Right.
But I don't have very high hopes it will actually be, like, reasonably fast enough. But, you say? You have to try it.
A lot of it depends on like what operations you need to do. A lot of buffer was moved to, I moved it to JavaScript simply because a lot of it is object manipulation, right? And so that is done faster in JavaScript. Whereas like setting read-only properties, or like sometimes you need to set hidden properties, or say you have a request, so you have a struct you need to tie to the object. That's stuff you have to do in C++. And since you're already there, not crossing the boundary is probably going to be the most beneficial. So yeah, it's really use case specific.
It's one of these things, moving the HTTP parser into JavaScript, it's one of these things that's like, it's a good idea to try. It might be pretty fast. And if we don't do it, then like, it's kind of silly that we have the parser in C++ and then we have some of these other bits of logic in JavaScript. They should probably be co-located.
Yes.
So whether that means moving that JS stuff into C++ or moving the, you know, and having a HTTP handle instead of a instead of just a socket object might be fine, but having these like multiple boundary hops is sort of, even though it's better in V8 3.20, it's still a little bit painful. And there may just be ways that we can make it less painful, and then it's, you know, it doesn't matter where things are.
Fortunately, because of us. fortunately, some Fetter in his, what was it, his TLS wrap or that thing he did, he implemented the ability to set our, we can now set our own, when a request comes in through Streamer app, we can now set a callback separate from the actual callback that's used normally. And that's given a ton of flexibility in how we handle specific requests. I don't think we're using it. We're using it in TLS wrap, of course. But we're not using it anywhere else, but I think it does have applicability elsewhere that will offer benefits, but we just need to figure out how to use it despite everything that's already been built up.
Yeah. Trevor, did you talk already about the StreamWrap set encoding stuff?
No. All right, so I'll briefly mention that. Basically, right now, when a connection comes in, a socket's created, and then you can set encoding on that. What currently happens is that the data comes in, it is immediately converted to a buffer and then handed off to JavaScript, and then it checks if an encoding has been set by the user. If it has, then it converts it to a string and then hands it off to the user. What we're trying to do is propagate the setting of set encoding all the way down to the C++ layer so that immediately when the data comes in, it can be converted to whatever encoding the user chose and then handed off directly back to the user so that there's no intermediary step. The big advantage there is just going to be in garbage collection. When you're receiving a large number of requests, GC is going to have to take a lot of time to clean up all those buffers, where it can handle like a string much better instead.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the pieces that we haven't really talked a lot about, is that we should in our documentation get some good how to use the best practices for buffers and also the C native binding side of things, trying to limit what primitives you're actually sending back and forth and how often you set your properties on the C side.
Okay, so one last thing that I wanted to mention. It came up at NodeBots Day, the end of the discussion, especially relating to Windows users. And there's apparently some issue that development on Serial Port wanted to get into Core. What are your thoughts about adding support for some of that, like that in Core?
No, we're probably not ever going to do that.
Why do you hate NodeBots?
I don't hate NodeBots. what we should work on making the native module, native add-on module story a little bit nicer, so that stuff like Node Serial Port and all binary modules really are much easier to do. And that's something that TJ is actively working on with this C API shim layer that's going to give you, you know, much broader compatibility, ABI compatibility across different stable versions. If you choose to use that. Also, Bert, I believe once upon a time you had talked about some libuv changes that would have made Node serial port streams a little less onerous and terrible to write.
Well, serial ports are not that complicated, and you know, actually they're fairly minimal, at least on Windows and Linux, which is all I know. But so I wouldn't mind adding support for it to libuv, but we are looking at a little, you know, a more complicated picture, because there's not only serial ports. There's a myriad of devices in your dev directory if you're a Unix user, and you know, one other thing that we should definitely support is pseudo terminals, and so like I wouldn't mind adding so like making that much nicer in libuv. The only problem is that the current libuv API is very specific towards particular types of streams. So for example, you have a type for TTYs or consoles, and one for datagrams, and one for TCP, and one for pipes. And so we don't want to keep extending this API forever. Mm. If it, you know, if we wanted to support like different kinds of devices, we would have to make one stream type basically. But there's complications with that. For example, that means that all these structs that keep the state for an open connection, for example, or an open pipe, all have to be the same size, which means we're gonna use much more memory for them, because some of them are quite big. Mm-hmm. And and it's just work also, like, and so there hasn't been much work going into like these areas lately. So if anyone wants to come and, you know, work on that, yes, you're welcome. But it's the only thing is that we won't just take a patch that adds like UV serial T or something, like another UV handle type. Like that's going too far in our opinion. So no, not for the moment.
Okay, so I think that's about going to wrap it up for this update. Thanks, guys, for coming on and getting us all plugged in. I hope that the upshot of this will be that people will begin their evaluation testing of 0.11. Now sooner, especially. Native module developers, seems like that's going to be a key thing to tune in early. Although that, you know, every version's kind of impacted that. So if you're actively developing a native module, I think that's kind of been something that you were expecting anyway. So gonna change up the format a little bit. We'll go through upcoming conferences, but I want to go and do our plugs now while everyone's still paying attention, and we'll go through conference announcements after that. So Bert, you want to kick off some plugs?
Oh, I wasn't even aware that I was supposed to do that, but obviously if I want to plug something, it would be not that nice sound. It would be a strong loop track. Check out our very nice distro, and you'll find it at strongloop.com. We can offer a lot more, including professional support for all the modules you use. And also stay tuned, because in the next month, actually, a lot more is coming. So maybe on next Node Up, you'll hear more.
Awesome. Trevor?
Mozilla? I mean,
of course. Firefox OS.
I think this
isn't go around and tell who you work for. This is like, you know, Bert happens to be a significant stakeholder in Strong Loop, which is why he's plugging it.
Exactly.
Mozilla.
Although I love Mozilla. All right.
TJ?
We could do that. Actually, I want to plug, if you guys haven't talked to Isaac about his reboot of Heroes, I think that everyone should have a conversation with Isaac about it, because it is very interesting.
Fan fiction Heroes reboot?
Yeah.
I want to full-on BSG that thing.
That's okay. Right.
I have to get like crazy rich first. But I've got some serious, like, that's an untapped, that's the saddest victim of the writer's strike.
So, which character are you planning on playing?
No. I'm not an actor. I'm not going to play anything. Like, we'll get real actors for it.
Strictly executive producing this, I think, is...
Right. No. Yeah, exactly. I'd be executive producing and probably do a lot of the writing and reviewing of it.
Who was Spock? The dude that Spock?
Leonard Nimoy?
No. The new Spock. It was also Siler in the...
Siler. Right. I think you can do a good Siler.
No, I'm not an actor. That's not what it's about. It's about the show could have been so much better.
Okay.
We'll discuss it sometime. That's an over beers talk.
Nice. So, Isaac.
So I wanted to plug NodeConf EU, which you're probably gonna get to mentioning, but I don't think you're gonna it's sold out, so you probably won't mention it even. But
I don't think it's sold out yet.
No, it's JSConf EU that's sold out.
JSConf EU is sold out? Oh, it's not sold out yet. Oh my goodness. You guys need to get.
I think there were like 18 tickets yesterday. So
I think there are like day only tickets or something. So you have to deal with your own accommodation. But it's going to be so awesome. It's going to be so awesome. I know secret things about it. I can't tell you, but I'm just telling you, it's going to be so awesome. I think everyone on this podcast is going to be there. Probably.
Yep.
Are you going to be there? I think.
Yeah, man. I'm talking. There's a picture of me in like Viking garb.
Wait, at NodeConf EU. I didn't even know that. Cool.
I'm the first one on the list, man. Me and Dominic Carr. Deshaw's there. Michael Rogers, James Halliday.
Nice.
Okay. Bert, I think you're going to be there, right?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Speaking or just hanging out?
No, I'm speaking.
All right, cool. Maybe. Yeah, your picture looks even less like you than everyone else's.
Awesome. So NodeConf EU, get a day ticket if that's all that's available. It's going to be amazing. So I'm going to plug Class Dojo and Class Dojo tiringness, looking for someone to come on and work on our public-facing API for behavior management in schools. So great feel-good project and really fun sort of technical project as well. So here we go, blasting through conferences. Isaac, you want to 1-2 this with me?
Yeah, all right. All right. So CampJS is going to be in Australia, the land where you can ride kangaroos to work every day. CampJS.com. It's August 9th to the 12th in 2013. In the Common Era. Similar style and feel to NodeConf 2013, but more hacky and has a bit more workshop. So lots of Node stuff and lots of good hands-on things in Australia.
Awesome. Node Knockout, September 6th through 8th. It's going to be worldwide, nodeknockout.com.
NodeConf EU, which I just plugged, is in Ireland. The picture on the website pretty much says it all. That's at nodeconf.eu or nodeconfeu.com. The last batch of tickets is on sale now, so you have to get them while they're hot.
Speaking of hot tickets, LXJS is going to be October 2nd through 3rd in Lisbon, Portugal. I think we're coming down to the wire there for the last batch of tickets as well. LXJS.org.
Jing.js is Node in Beijing from October 19th through 20th. I believe I've heard that it's related somewhat to the Huge.js conference as well. But so that went really, really well. I believe there's a lot of great talent going to be there at jingjs.org.
And I think you got the dates wrong, though. As far as I know, they might have moved it. It's November 9th and 10th. So,
okay.
Not October 19th.
Cool. Yes. All
right.
Thank you for the correction.
So Cascadia.js, and I believe this was another recent shift in dates. So if you had it on your calendar, double check this. November 14th through 15th in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I've heard someone's going to grab TJ and drag him to the event. 2013.cascadia.js.com. Node Summit.
And, sorry, I got distracted. Yeah, Node Summit 2013, December 3 and 4. This is going to be for your business node for the businesses. Wear your suits and expensive ties and hand out business cards with other business people for the business talking about Node. That's nodesummit2013.eventbrite.com. It's actually not as boring as I'm making it out to be. It's a pretty cool conference.
So we had a good groove there. Wrap it up with RobotsConf. If you participated in NodeBots Day, there's a special discount. December 6th through 7th, RobotsConf.com, run by the one, the only Voodoo Tiki God, Chris Williams. And it is going to be in sunny Florida. So you're going to be able to go and enjoy the sun and some robots and the ocean and the pool, and robots really love the pool, so that'll be fun.
So everybody, please leave a review in iTunes. Even if you don't listen to this thing on iTunes, that helps us very, very much. Follow at NodeUp on Twitter, and you'll know when we're live. You should also hang out in the IRC channel, which is NodeUp on irc.freenode.net. And if that's not enough for you and you want us to talk about your thing, then talk to us about sponsoring NodeUp.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. It's a really great show and a really helpful update. So appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Bye.
Bye, guys. Thank you.